The accuracy increased dramatically. The rate of fire could as much as quadruple. And so the percentage of hits that the battleships would get using this technique could increase by as much as 1,000%.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Thank everybody for coming this afternoon, and thank you to the Naval Academy Museum and the Class of 1950 for hosting these Scheifele lectures. With the opening of the new exhibit downstairs, it's really exciting to be here because some of the folks I'm going to talk about today are in the displays in the exhibit about the Naval Institute. I have to remind everybody in opening that as you can see from my uniform of choice today, I am here in my personal and academic capacity, and anything I say should be construed as my opinion alone and not representing the U.S. government or any agency. So today, innovation seems like the favorite buzzword in the Pentagon or in Washington, D.C. And discussion swirls around this idea that times are ripe right now for changes and reforms. The examples, though, that are commonly held up for us about how to do this usually seem to come from Silicon Valley. And just earlier this week, I read an article telling us all about the lessons that we can learn from tech and from venture capital for military innovation. These examples and these lessons somehow seem incomplete to me. They equate the military and the realities of military culture as being directly parallel to the business world. As a historian, these comparisons appear to be poorly constructed. Now, I've done some reading and some research, and I have a story to tell you today about an officer who innovated, an officer who changed the Navy from the inside as a lieutenant from his stateroom in the Pacific. This is Vice Admiral William Souden Sims. Now, William Sims was clearly not always a vice admiral, and in 1900 he was a lieutenant, and he was coming fresh off of staff duty where he had been an intelligence officer in Europe. And he had orders to join the USS Kentucky, the most powerful and newest battleship in the US Navy. Now, in Europe, he'd been studying battleship design as an intelligence officer, and he'd been studying the gunnery techniques of both our potential adversaries and our potential allies. Sims checked on board the USS Kentucky, and he discovered that the Navy's newest and most powerful was definitely new, but it might not be that powerful. There were some very serious design flaws with this ship, despite all its trumpeting in the newspapers. I'll give you a couple examples. The hull was armored down under the waterline. Now remember, this is the days before the self-propelled torpedo, so there was nothing that could hit the ship under the waterline. So it was wasted weight, and it slowed the ship down. The gun turrets, you can kind of see along the side there on the gun deck, had these massive openings, which was great for moving the gun back and forth, traversing to aim, but it also meant that it wasn't armored very well. You can also see that now she's sitting kind of high on the water here, but when she's fully loaded and took heavy seas, water would pour into those gun turrets because it was so low. And the final straw in Sims's mind was that there was no differentiation. There was no way to armor the decks between the gun decks and the magazines below. So a shot that hit the ship could penetrate directly into the magazines and explode, potentially a fatal flaw, and one that would cost lives later on in US Navy history. So Sims was incensed, and he set about writing a report about these deficiencies that he found. And he wrote a letter to a friend after he'd written the report. And in the letter he said, "The Kentucky is not a battleship at all. She is the worst crime in naval construction ever perpetrated by the white race." Now, allowing for the early 20th century race language there, Sims was clearly a man with strong opinions. However, he was also part of Kentucky's crew, and he knew that he couldn't change the design of the ship while they were deployed. So he set about getting his qualifications back, and he started standing his bridge watches, and he started looking for a way to improve the ship through what today are called tactics, techniques, or procedures, or the acronym used in the Navy around the world as TTPs. So it was while steaming through the South China Sea and visiting the cities of southern China that he met a Royal Navy officer who would serve as an inspiration. Now, Admiral Percy Scott was a captain in 1900, and he was the commanding officer of the HMS Terrible. He was a bit of a troublemaker in his own service, and he didn't get along real well with many of his peers. And later on, a couple years later, he'd have a pretty significant feud with an admiral in the Royal Navy. Now, Scott had developed something that he called continuous aim fire, and it was a TTP that he thought could revolutionize naval warfare. But he couldn't get anyone to pay attention to what was going on. In fact, when he used the technique in gunnery competitions, the Royal Navy accused him of cheating. So let's talk about gunnery for a minute here at the turn of the century. It hadn't really changed a whole lot since the days of Constitution fighting it out with the frigates in the War of 1812. So the gun director would set the elevation of the weapon, kind of guess where the enemy was going to be to hit them. And then they'd load the weapon and they'd time the roll of the ship. And he'd fire, timing the roll to try and hit the enemy. Now, this was the reason why most decisive engagements in the Age of Sail were very close range affairs, because it wasn't a very accurate way to shoot and it wasn't a very fast way to shoot either. So what Percy Scott did was he re-geared the elevation gear on the guns on the HMS Terrible. And he added telescopic sights to the guns. Now, the new gearing would allow the gun director to constantly be moving the barrel of the weapon as the ship rolled. And the telescopic sight allowed him to keep the barrel pointed at the enemy as the ship rolled around him. What this meant was now the ship could shoot as fast as they could reload. There was no timing of the firing involved here. So Lieutenant Sims watched the crews on Terrible and what they were able to accomplish, and he was blown away by what was going on. A battleship using continuous aim fire might even be able to take on a whole squadron of ships that wasn't. The accuracy increased dramatically. The rate of fire could as much as quadruple. And so the percentage of hits that the battleships would get using this technique could increase by as much as 1,000%, depending on the ship. Sims immediately wrote a report and sent it off to the Bureau of Ordnance in Washington, D.C. So Lieutenant Sims befriended Captain Scott, and he learned exactly how the Brits were doing this. And he took it back to the American ships, and he figured out how to re-gear the guns on the American ships. And he started training American gun crews in this new technique. Soon he had some crews that were performing just as well as those on the Terrible. He wrote another report in which he detailed what he had discovered, exactly how you would change the gearing on American guns, what techniques to use to teach the gun crews how to conduct continuous aim fire. And he sent it off to Washington. And he waited. And he waited. And he waited. He heard nothing in return. Now, his reports had arrived at the Washington Navy Yard, at the Bureau of Ordnance, and they were read by the experts there. But what this lieutenant claimed out on China Station was outlandish. It was simply impossible. There was no way. And so they took the reports and they filed them in a file cabinet in the basement, and they forgot about them. See, it was the Bureau of Ordnance where the guns had been designed that were on American ships, and where the tactics, techniques, and procedures that were currently in use had been designed. And everyone knew that American ingenuity and American firepower and American sailors were the best in the world, right? No one even asked the question, what if the lieutenant's right? What could a lieutenant possibly know? So now I want to take a pause in the story here for a moment and get a little interdisciplinary on you. Over the past decade or so, Dr. Angela Duckworth and a team of her researchers at the University of Pennsylvania have been studying successful innovators and intellectual competitors. In their studies and experiments, they've discovered that the ability to stick with it, a never-say-die attitude, if you will, is central to the success of innovative measures. They call this trait grit. And in one of their studies, they studied two traits and compared them, grit versus openness to new experiences and new ideas. Now, obviously, in innovation, openness to new things is kind of the starting point. It's the key to a reform or doing something different. But what they discovered in their study was actual success depended more on grit. This is because innovation is as much about the competition between the innovator and the forces of the status quo as it is about the idea itself. Grit can be even more important than the new idea. So whether we're talking about Beethoven taking 9 years to write, or 6 years to write his Ninth Symphony, trying to get it exactly right before performance, or say Stephen King submitting his novel Carrie to 30 different publishers before he finally finds someone who would print it, grit, the never say die attitude, is key to innovation and creative success. So Lieutenant Sims certainly had grit. Even though he heard nothing from Washington, he continued to work. They developed new tactics that would go along with this method. They tinkered with the gearing mechanisms even more and improved a way to change them. And he worked on new training techniques to bring gun crews along faster in the use of continuous aim fire. He still heard no responses from Washington, and he knew what was happening. He knew that the Bureau was ignoring him because he was just some junior officer out on deployment. Sims had never been on their staff. He was not one of their recognized experts. And he wrote a letter to a friend of his in which he said, "With every fiber of my being, I loathe indirection and shiftiness. And where it occurs in high place and is used to save face at the expense of the vital interests of our great service, in which silly people put such childlike trust, I want that man's blood, and I will have it no matter what it costs me personally." So clearly he was a passionate individual, maybe a little bit aggressive. He wrote in some of his other letters that he certainly respected his senior officers and the ranks involved, but the rank alone wasn't going to impress him. It was what they did or had done that impressed him. Naval staffs that stood on bureaucracy and just keeping the machine going, instead of improving combat effectiveness and improving the service, were his enemy, and he was going to view it that way. Now, I'd say that William Sims might be said to have true grit. He continued. He kept writing reports. Now the language in his reports changed and it became more dramatic because he started talking about what would happen to the US Navy if someone else started using this and we got in a battle with them, because we would lose. He started using dramatic language. He got his commanding officer to start endorsing the reports. And on his own initiative, he started sending them to battleship captains all over the world, not just to the Bureau of Ordnance back in Washington. He also got the admiral, who was in charge of Asiatic Squadron, to endorse his reports also. They'd seen what Terrible and Kentucky had done. There was no way around it. So as word spread throughout the fleet, because he'd been circulating these reports, the Bureau realized they were going to need to do something. They were getting letters from captains all over the world saying, "Hey, is this true? Does this work? Do we need to start doing this?" So the Bureau of Ordnance developed a test in order to prove that continuous aim fire didn't work. That was the intent of their test. And they completed their test, and they wrote a report in which they said it was, quote, "a mathematical impossibility to do what Lieutenant Sims claimed." Now, they didn't change the gearing mechanism on the guns like his reports required. And they conducted the test right there on the edge of the Anacostia River on dry land for a technique meant for a rolling ship at sea. Now, I was a history major here at the Academy, but I learned enough physics to know that they had a problem in how they conducted their test. But they sent the report out to the fleet and message traffic nonetheless, and they said this was impossible. And belief in Sims and what he was doing disappeared almost overnight. Now, Sims had submitted 13 reports in all over the span of 2 years, each one continually improving and making better the techniques for continuous aim fire. When the Bureau of Ordnance had completed their test and said what he was doing was impossible, he finally had enough. He knew that if the US Navy went up against a force that was using continuous aim fire, the fleet would lose. And that would leave the Eastern Seaboard open to invasion, just like it happened in the War of 1812. You have to put yourself in his shoes. The War of 1812 to him was just as distant as World War I is to us. It was a very real thing in the Navy's memory that the British were able to invade. The nation's security depended on his success. So Lieutenant Sims did something that he would later characterize when he was an admiral as the rankest kind of insubordination. He wrote a letter directly to the President of the United States. The President of the United States was one Theodore Roosevelt at the time. He had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy Roosevelt. He was a navalist by the very definition of the word. At 24 years old, when he graduated from Harvard, he wrote his first book, the seminal The Naval War of 1812. He was personal friends with Alfred Thayer Mahan, the strategist and historian, and he'd become the inventor of the Great White Fleet and its deployer. Now, as presidents sometimes did over 100 years ago, he actually read the letter that the lieutenant on China Station had sent him. And he realized that if what Sims claimed was true, Sims was also right, that it was a matter of national importance. See, Roosevelt had ordered a gunnery exercise not long after becoming the president in order to demonstrate the existing state of American naval skill. The results had been worse than anyone had imagined they could be. Five ships from the Atlantic Fleet went out into the Atlantic, and from about a mile distance, each one was given 5 minutes to shoot at a target that was a light ship, an old retired light ship. So after 25 minutes of blasting away at this target, the Atlantic Fleet had managed to put shells through the sail twice and not hit the ship at all. Roosevelt ordered that William Sims come back from China Station. And in his bluster at the White House, he was reputed as having said, "Give him entire charge of target practice for 18 months. Do exactly as he says. If he does not accomplish anything in that time, cut off his head and try someone else." So Lieutenant Sims returned to the United States, and he assumed the responsibilities of the inspector of target practice. He had this position for 6 years. He was given two lieutenants to serve as his assistants in the office. Three lieutenants changed the world of naval warfare. No problem. Sims began by recirculating the reports that he had written, sending them out to the fleet. He also instituted required annual target practice training. There actually had been no requirement previous to this that captains drill their crews. He didn't make continuous aim fire mandatory. He just sent out the reports and said, start with however you want. This might be an idea. He began traveling to ships and training gun crews and briefing wardrooms on how to conduct better gunnery exercises. He established a yearly fleet gunnery competition. Every ship in the Navy had to compete. They could use any technique that they wanted. Surely continuous aim fire was open, but it wasn't required. The winning ship would be identified throughout the entire Navy. It would be in the newspapers and heralded as the best naval ship of the day. Each year, the gunnery officer on the winning ship had one requirement. He had to write a report and tell everybody else how he did it, how he won. And so every year as these reports piled up, the gunnery officers would pore over them and try and figure out tricks to do things faster, to hit things better. They started writing their own reports, and they started writing articles for the Naval Institute's Journal for Disruptive Thinkers called Proceedings. The winning ship each year received a pennant that they could fly from their yardarm with a giant E emblazoned on it for gunnery excellence. This is the birth of the competition that today is known as the Battle E and continues every year between ships and squadrons in the U.S. Navy. Sims was promoted to lieutenant commander, and he and his assistants, Lieutenants Ridley McLean and Powers Symington, were in constant demand throughout the fleet. Here you can see an invitation for the gun doctor. You can see him on his throne there with his two assistants, Ping and Pong. And it's an invitation to join the USS Missouri for what was called a silent dinner. Now, a silent dinner was kind of something like a mess night or a dining in with rules like Vegas. What's talked about at the silent dinner stays at the silent dinner. And at nights like these, at the end of dinner over port wine and cigars, William Sims would encourage the junior officers throughout the fleet on their own innovations and their own insurgent attitudes to take on the bureaucracy. He was leading a revolution in gunnery, but he wanted them to revolutionize and professionalize the entire service. Towards the end of his years leading the gunnery revolution, one gunner on a winning ship made 15 hits in the span of 1 minute on a target 75 feet by 25 feet at the same distance as President Roosevelt's tests just a few years before. Over half of the hits were within a bullseye that was 50 inches square. The U.S. Navy quickly overtook the Royal Navy as the best gunners in the world. It wasn't until the U.S. adopted continuous aim fire that the Brits realized that Percy Scott had been onto something all along, and they began doing it as well. Even Admiral Newton Mason, the chief of the Bureau of Ordnance, was forced to admit the renaissance in gunnery, which came about chiefly through the instrumentality of Commander Sims, has led to great improvements in ordnance. I guess it's a bureaucrat's way of saying good job. Now in the fleet, William Sims became known as, quote, the man who taught us how to shoot, unquote. So as opposed to the lessons of Steve Jobs or Facebook or Tesla, here we have a real historical example of innovation from inside the U.S. Navy. Now, what can we learn from it? Now, there are some important observations that we can make for junior officers and for enlisted sailors who want to improve their service, who want to innovate and make things better. First, you have to know where your expertise lies, and you have to study. You have to do the deep research and the hard work of learning about your subject matter. More importantly, maybe you have to learn why things are the way they are, because without knowing this, you won't know what exactly needs to be changed. Now, you see this with Sims working with his wardroom mates and working with his gunner's mates as he's constantly improving continuous aim fire. It's important that you admit that you don't know everything, because making that admission is the first step to learning as much as possible and becoming the expert in your field. Now, you also have to find a way to talk about your idea. And take the lesson from Sims, don't be insubordinate about it. And honestly, today, writing a letter to the president in our modern world probably isn't going to get you very far. But there are ways to work inside the system. In the Navy today, you can write change suggestions for manuals or write white papers to send up the chain of command to improve TTPs. There are methods inside the lifelines. Most people just don't use them. Now, sometimes you also need to take measures outside the lifelines. And that can mean writing an article for Proceedings or for SimSec or one of the many other online publications that are out there today. You can also engage with the community and branch organizations. So organizations like the Surface Navy Association, Tailhook, or the Naval Helicopter Association. These can be the heart of new ideas if we just allow them to be. And third, you need to find something that you believe in. You need to find something that you can demonstrate your own grit. This isn't going to get you another ribbon on your rack of your uniform. This isn't necessarily about getting a fit rep bullet. Okay, this is about professionalism, and this is about improving the U.S. Naval Service. It's about national security. You have to want to spend 2 years writing 13 reports that maybe nobody is reading. That takes heart and it takes hard work, but this is what it takes to truly innovate in a big bureaucracy or in the Navy. Christopher Hitchens wrote in his book, Letters to a Young Contrarian, don't expect to be thanked. The life of an oppositionist is supposed to be difficult. But what about senior officers? Or maybe even worse, what about those of us who are the dreaded staff officers that are out there? Are there lessons that we can learn here too? I think there are. See, because the history as I've related it to you is pretty much the way William Sims would have told the story and the way it appears in many of our history books. But if you go dig into the archives and you read some of the letters and some of the reports of the day, you realize that while Sims was certainly the brains and the brawn behind the gunnery revolution, he was certainly not alone. When he was on China Station, the commander-in-chief of the Asiatic Squadron was Rear Admiral George Remy. The Admiral was a hero of the Spanish-American War and one of the most highly respected officers in the U.S. Navy of that day. He held a position that roughly today is kind of the equivalent of PACOM, the senior military official in the Pacific. Sims' reports went through Admiral Remy on their way back to Washington, and he always added an endorsement speaking to how important they were. They were always positive endorsements. And Sims' time on China Station wasn't spent exclusively on board Kentucky, because after the first couple reports he sent, Admiral Remy brought him on board the flagship Brooklyn to join his staff. He was given a position called Special Intelligence Officer. It was an invented position. It didn't exist on the staff. And Remy told Sims that he could study and write about whatever he wanted, whether that included the growing conflict between Japan and Russia in Pacific waters, different designs of battleships that came through the region, or gunnery techniques and improvement of TTPs. And Sims wrote about all of those things while in that position. When President Roosevelt decided that he wanted William Sims brought back from China Station, he had the bully pulpit. What he didn't actually technically have was the ability to cut orders and move a lieutenant across the world. That responsibility rested with the head of the Bureau of Navigation, and that was Admiral Henry Taylor. Now, Taylor was known as something of a reformer himself. He had helped establish the General Board of the Navy just a few years before. So when the president passed the word down suggesting that Sims be brought in from China Station, Taylor took a moment and he asked the officers on his staff what they thought about this idea. And he started with the senior officers, the captains and the commanders, and they all pretty much said, you're setting yourself up for a problem. This Sims guy is a loose cannon. He's out of control and he is not going to play nice. You cannot give him this job. But Taylor wasn't done asking people their advice. He then turned to the lieutenant commanders and the lieutenants on his staff, and he asked them what they thought. And almost to a man, they said he was, quote, the real deal, unquote, and that they better bring Sims from China Station because he would fix this problem. Taylor obviously sided with the junior officers and brought Sims back. But he did more than that. William Sims needed time in order to prove his success. And it was Admiral Taylor that was the one who was able to give him the top cover and buy him the time he needed to show that his methods worked in the fleet. Now, these senior leaders recognized that innovation from the junior ranks is the lifeblood of a vibrant and combat-effective military organization. They were on the lookout for smart young officers with new ideas, with their own expertise, and with the grit to follow them through. They needed protection, and they needed encouragement. This is just as important today as it was over a century ago. But it wasn't just the contribution of the flag officers and the president that helped make Sims' gunnery revolution possible. It was his peers and staff officers all over the world also. Sims had a wide network of friends, and they corresponded regularly. And they shared ideas for developing their own innovations, and they shared intelligence, and they shared support all over the world. They called themselves, quote, the Society for the Repression of Ignorant Assumptions, unquote. Now, these included men like Admiral Bradley Fisk, who was a lieutenant at the time. And in the 1890s, Fisk, as a lieutenant, was the one who invented the telescopic sight and how you mount it on a big gun on a battleship. Fisk wrote numerous articles for Proceedings, and he held the most patents of any naval officer for 50 years either side of him. He also had important roles later on in his career. When he was part of the Secretary of the Navy's staff, he was the central figure in the establishment of the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. And he would later go on to develop the first tactics for aerial dive bombing and torpedo attacks against ships. Then there was Ridley MacLean. And MacLean, as a junior officer, served with Sims out on China Station. He was on Kentucky. And he was called back to Washington with Sims to be one of his assistants in the target practice office. It was MacLean who actually had the job to sit down and write the procedures for the gunnery manual for the US Navy, the one who had to translate Sims' excited briefings into a useful manual for the fleet. He also decided that really enlisted sailors in the fleet needed a manual to help guide them as well. And he wrote the very first edition of the Blue Jackets Manual, a manual that has been updated every year since and is still given to sailors in boot camp and to midshipmen here at the Naval Academy. He commanded a battleship in World War I, and he'd go on to become one of the early commanders of the U.S. Submarine Force, battling with the bureaucracy for funding and support for this innovative new weapon. Now, both McLean and Fisk would become admirals later in their careers. There was also Philip Alger, who was a classmate of William Sims, and who you can see in the right corner there. He was a classmate here at Annapolis with him, but after his first term, Alger left the Navy. But he came back here to Annapolis to a job as a professor of ordnance and gunnery. And it was in that job as a professor here at the Academy that he became one of the experts, the outside consultants, the Bureau of Ordnance would invite down to Washington to talk about new ideas with. So he saw the debates about Sims' work from the inside of the Bureau and was able to write letters back to Sims, sharing with him intelligence, who was against him, who was for him, who was trying to undermine his innovations. Later on, he and Sims would work together on articles for proceedings that then Alger would publish to try and keep the heat off of Sims. Military innovation depends on new ideas from junior leaders, men and women with experience, with grit, with the willingness to work hard and challenge the status quo. But it also requires senior leaders who are willing to nurture those new ideas and help the people who have them, even if they border on the insubordinate or, as General Mattis said, look like a bag of mud. And it requires staff officers and peers being supportive all over the world. We can't just sit at our desk and use the power of saying no. Commanders and captains have to provide leadership, constructive criticism, and encouragement for concept development, rather than embracing and wielding the power of the staff veto. Now, Sims went on to embody all of these traits himself as he became more senior. When Admiral Sims arrived in London at the start of World War I, he was placed in command of all US naval forces in the war. And he was approached by a group of young lieutenants. These officers were the commanding officers of a new type of warship. It was called the destroyer. And they had this idea that they could convoy ships across the Atlantic and they could halt the U-boat menace that was really decimating the supply lines to Europe. Now, at the time, it wasn't really in the newspapers, but the reality was England was on the verge of starvation. If the U-boats continued to have the success that they were having in the middle of 1917, the US was never going to get to the war. And England would probably falter. Sims immediately understood the power of the convoy and what these JOs were suggesting, and he went to the Admiralty that had denied them the ability to do this throughout the war. And he said, I will bring destroyers from the United States to augment the force, and we're going to try this. And the Admiralty agreed. And convoy operations were almost an overnight success. And the US and the UK and Canada went on to win the first battle of the Atlantic against the U-boats. The very definition of a battleship admiral, William Sims cabled back to the United States and told the Navy Department to stop building battleships for the war and put all of the effort into more destroyers for the swarming attacks on the U-boats. Now, later on, as president of the Naval War College, Sims would institute war games and studies that would progress through the interwar years leading up to World War II. And these studies would develop the idea that naval aviation was central to the future of naval warfare and that submarines were going to be a vital component of any future war. It caused him to write a letter to Bradley Fisk in the early 1920s in which he said, quote, "The battleship is dead." Unquote. So William Sims offers us an example to learn from. Throughout his career, he worked inside the system, But when he needed to, he also worked outside the system, and he wrote articles and gave lectures to help spread innovation more widely throughout the fleet and throughout naval circles. The book 21st Century Sims, Innovation, Education, and Leadership for the Modern Era is a collection of some of these articles and these speeches. In these works, Sims discusses innovation in battleship design and the future of naval ships. He lays out a plan for how to educate officers for the positions that require strategic knowledge and strategic decision making. He addresses some of the problems with the officer promotion system and the selection system, problems that unfortunately remain quite relevant today, 100 years later. Most importantly, William Sims repeatedly comments on the sometimes overwhelming nature of military conservatism and how it slows improvement in our military and sometimes even places national security at risk. It's his thinking on how to overcome this conservatism, the natural inclination of uniformed officers to embrace the status quo, through leadership and education, that's probably the most important lesson of his writing. From his personal experience, we can see the importance of expertise, the value of finding the right venue for your ideas, the importance of grit and seeing it through to the end. We also see illustrations of the importance of senior officers who support insurgent thinkers and new ideas, and staff officers who band together to make things work. However, there's a reason that the title of my slides earlier said lessons observed. These are just observations that I've made from reading some history and getting into some of the archives. However, whether or not these observations are actually lessons learned instead of just lessons observed, well, that's going to depend on our midshipmen and our officers and enlisted in uniform today. Thank you very much. Questions?
Yeah, BJ, so I guess you identified William Sims as innovation of continuous fire and then the follow-on convoy tactics. So I see those as like bottom-up innovations where people are working within the system, but in some ways bucking, the bureaucracy, which would happen otherwise. So I think there's a tendency for organizations in the Navy to say, oh, okay, so we've identified these ideas as successful, and these people are successful, so we want more Sims, right? And so we try approaches like task force innovation, or they're more what I would call top-down approaches to innovation, where we try to select and direct people. I just wonder if you had thoughts on those two different forms of innovation, or if they're not really different forms of innovation.
Well, I think they're certainly related in methodology and how they're done, right? So the top down, if you will, is really more a matter of how instead of if you do that. Mm-hmm. So for example, Sims in his military conservatism essay talks about the fact that most innovation, in fact, almost all the examples that he lists in that essay started at the bottom and worked their way up. Okay? It's not a matter of some admiral having a great idea. Sims doesn't believe that really admirals have great ideas. It's that at that point in their career, they have the experience and the knowledge to recognize somebody else's great idea and grab it and try and make it work. And I think looking at Sims' own experience, his development, his implementation of continuous aim fire is probably as important to this story as him being out in his stateroom writing reports for 2 years. Right? The implementation part is critical. Did he force anybody to do anything? No, he didn't. Okay? And today we have phrases and buzzwords like crowdsourcing. Okay, guess what Sims was doing? Right. He was suggesting to everybody in the Navy that they were part of this improvement. Everybody in the Navy had the opportunity to be part of the innovation. And that's the trick, is finding the culture that embraces that, because that's where we're going to find success. The danger of things like the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, Task Force Innovation, I will remind everyone, I said earlier the disclaimer, these are my personal opinions. The danger with those is They have the potential to stovepipe things. And instead of spreading a culture widely across the Navy that embraces professionalism and embraces innovation as a central part of who we are, it stovepipes them. It places them in a special place that only the really innovative people go. And that potentially could lead to failure, as opposed to a broader and wider embrace of these kinds of ideas.
Thank you.
Cool. BJ, could you talk about the relationship between Sims and Teddy Roosevelt prior to Sims sending a letter?
Yeah, so the way the story comes across and the way that the history books kind of tell it, it sounds like he just sent this letter over the transom and was lucky to get recognized. The thing was, Roosevelt and Sims had run across each other a couple years before. As I said, Sims joins the Kentucky from intelligence duty in Europe, and you know, if you do the timeline in your head, he was in Europe during the Spanish-American War. He was at the Paris Embassy as the assistant attaché, and in those days, the attaché was clearly an intelligence officer, and Sims ran a spy ring in Spain in the lead-up to the Spanish-American War. At that period, the State Department really wasn't very good at collecting actionable intelligence for the U.S. government. And there were no intelligence organizations as we know them today, so the military guys were kind of it. So Sims was pretty much providing the only really good material back to Washington from Europe and from Spain in the lead up to the war. And so Assistant Secretary of the Navy Roosevelt, obviously if you know the history of the war, was centrally involved in the lead up to that war and preparing the Navy for it. And so on the day before he resigned his position as Assistant Secretary of the Navy to go become Colonel Roosevelt of the Rough Riders and go to Cuba himself, he actually wrote a letter to this lieutenant in Paris whose reports he had been poring over for the past several months. He wrote him a letter and said, "You are doing incredible work. You are vital to the national security of the nation. Or the security of the nation. And keep it up, and please keep going. Whoever my successor is going to be just as interested in these reports as I have been." So Roosevelt sent this letter to Sims, Lieutenant Sims. So a few years later, when Sims decides he's going to write a letter to the president, he actually corresponds with a friend of his before he does it. He says, "Do you think he'll remember me? Maybe I can actually get this letter on his desk. He might recognize my name." So there was a little bit of a background here. And then there's also, you know, more history to go after the Gunnery Revolution, or actually during it, about halfway through his time as Inspector of Target Practice, Sims becomes dual-hatted, as we call it in the Navy. He has two jobs. He's the Inspector of Target Practice, and he's one of the naval aides to President Theodore Roosevelt. Now, Roosevelt actually advances him ahead of his peers, head of some officers who were senior to him, to give him command of the USS Minnesota in 1909 when he was just a commander. So not necessarily making friends with all of his peers in that situation, but yeah, Roosevelt was a central figure in this story, kind of behind the scenes.
Ms. Sierra, do you think that it's easier today or more difficult to get innovative ideas out with the increase in technology, but also multiple publications where lots of ideas are thrown out, but it's there's so many sources and so many ideas, it's hard to get the good ones recognized?
I think you make a really great observation, right? Because on the one hand, it's easier today. Information technology has made organizations like CIMSEC, the Center for International Maritime Security, which was started by a group of lieutenants who wanted to have their own think tank. You know, so it's reminiscent of the early days of the Naval Institute. And they started their own organization and they published the Next War blog, where they have a lot of great content, a lot of great material, a lot of great ideas. And because of the internet, it's relatively easy to get those ideas out there. You know, social media today, whether you want to talk about them or guys like War on the Rocks, who are kind of starting a more academic and more national security oriented journal and publication online, or the Strategy Bridge, there's lots of folks out there that want to publish new ideas. So you're right, it makes it easier. Now, does it also make it harder because more of them are out there? You know, I like to think that quality will stand up, right? Now, part of that means that we as naval officers have to be able to communicate our ideas effectively. And there are some elements to our educational system and its reliance on engineering STEM subjects that don't necessarily help naval officers communicate that well, particularly in written word. The ability to write a good article that an editor is going to read and say, this is great, and that maybe more importantly in this day and age, that the public that reads it is going to embrace, it's not easy. It takes hard work, and it takes skill and preparation to get there. So I like to think that the quality ideas, the well-presented ideas, they're going to rise to the top. And so that overall, the increase in our ability to communicate with social media and with digital publishing today is a positive. But there is a potential downside there, and it's valuable to recognize that.
Rebel Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.